This week on Behind the Lens.
We are on track likely to be the next one of those southern states making the national headlines unless something is done to change this trajectory.
Louisiana rejoins the list of states with rising caseloads of coronavirus, but some politicians are crying foul over pandemic precautions. That's troubling for medical professionals. So are the growing number of tourists coming to New Orleans. We'll also have raps from the education and criminal justice beats, and the Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation rebrands itself for changing times, but its mission remains a serious one. We'll hear from Christy Trail in this hour. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. Welcoming listeners on our partner radio stations, 90.3 WAMFLP and 102.3 FM WHIVLP New Orleans. Kicking off the podcast this week, a finding that the city of New Orleans may miss out on tens of millions of dollars in federal relief funding amid the COVID-19 crisis. As Michael Isaac Stein reports, state lawmakers had other plans for that money.
Here we're talking about the Federal CARES Act, and part of that federal law provided funding to state governments to help cover the costs related to responding to this virus. So Louisiana was awarded $1.8 billion. Originally, Governor John Bel Edwards had said that the state was going to keep $1 billion for its own budget while distributing a little over $800 million to other local governments. So here we're talking about city governments, parish governments, things like that. Now, what happened, it became, kind of one of the main events during the latest legislative session. Republican legislators, ended up achieving, kind of slicing off $300 million out of that CARES Act money that instead of going to local governments, it would go to small business grants. At this meeting this week at the city council, the city's chief financial officer, Norman White, told the city council that originally when $800 million was going to be going to local governments, under this formula, they expected New Orleans to be allotted roughly $150 million. However, now, instead of $800 million being available, he said it's closer to $484 million. Now, under this latter scenario that we're now facing, we don't know exactly how much we're going to get, but he said, they're expecting to get less than $93 million. So $57 million less than, the city was expecting under Governor Edwards' plan.
Do we have any sense of where this leaves the city financially amid some serious economic turmoil?
It's still a little hard to know exactly, how bad our budget gap is. The city is trying to wait until they know exactly how much they're going to get from the state. I mean, they said that we expect less than $93 million, but it's really still unknown what we're going to get. I mean, something that White said at the meeting as well is that, the allotment for each local government is partly dependent on how bad of a coronavirus outbreak that, was in that area. New Orleans and Jefferson parishes were some of the worst outbreaks towards the beginning, but now we see parishes all over the state that are seeing these huge spikes. Again, Norman White was talking about how as, spikes occur in different parts of the state, that could also be our allotment. So, yeah, I mean, how bad of a budget gap, we're facing this year, it's going to highly depend on how much of this CARES Act funding the city can ultimately get.
Michael, let's look at another issue on the city beat. The city council considering new limits on surveillance technology.
Yeah, so they're considering an ordinance right now sponsored by council member Jason Williams, who crafted it in conjunction with this organization, Eye on Surveillance, which is a local coalition of individuals and groups who are concerned about New Orleans, expanding, growing surveillance system. Now, the ordinance, it provides some outright bans on certain technologies. So we're talking about facial recognition, license plate readers, and a couple other specific pieces of technology would be banned. Perhaps the more important part of the ordinance, though, is it aims to set up a process for the city council to approve and review new types of surveillance. Under the rules outlined in this draft ordinance, when a city department wanted to install a new piece of surveillance technology, which can be anything from video cameras to data collection to x-ray vans, you know, there's a lot listed in the ordinance, but any city department or agency that wanted to add, you know, one of these new pieces of technology, they would have to submit an application to the city council. And that application would have to include a lot of information, you know, specific to the equipment they were buying or the software they were buying. But it would also have to outline the intended use of this technology, which, you know, surveillance critics say is vitally important because it's not just, you know, the power of these tools. It's how you use them. The council then, after that application, has the choice to approve the new use. But even if they approve that use, that only lasts for 3 years. So 3 years later, that city department would have to come back and ask for permission all over again.
Michael Isaac Stein reporting for The Lens. As always, a pleasure, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
We want to pull back and get a look at the broader picture of how the state overall is coping with the COVID-19 pandemic. That picture is not a pretty one. The state health department itself reporting just a few minutes ago, as we record on Friday afternoon, the state saw 2,642 new COVID-19 cases on Friday. That's the single largest daily increase not attributable to testing backlogs since the outbreak began in early March. We spoke with Rosemary Westwood from our partner station, 89.9 FM WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. She's monitoring the crisis across the state.
Rosemary, what are some of the data points you examined in your report?
The big one that jumped out for me is that Louisiana now ranks third in the U.S. for new cases per capita on a rolling 7-day average. And that's according to Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. So we have been hearing a lot about Florida, about Arizona and Texas, but what this says is that we are on track likely to be the next one of those southern states making the national headlines unless something is done to change this trajectory. New cases per capita are a very good measure of the spread of the virus, and they indicate trouble to come, really. So that really stood out to me. And what I take away from that, and what the, you know, officials and experts I talked to took away from that, is that people are going out into public. They're probably in bars and restaurants in close contact with others. They're not wearing masks, likely, basically not following the guidance that the health department has set out. And there are a few regions that really jump out for people when I ask them where we should be most concerned. One is Lake Charles. Lake Charles is, it was earlier this week in the top for new cases per capita. It's now second today, according to Harvard's data, but that is still quite concerning. Lafayette is another one. And a hospital executive released a video last week noting that that hospitalizations had grown 200% over the past couple of weeks at her hospital in Lafayette. So those stand out. East Baton Rouge Parish obviously is another region we're really concerned about. Another one of the big indicators for how much the virus is spreading is the percent of positive cases that we have. So that's not just about how much testing we're doing, but how much virus there really is. And that has topped 12% this week. The state has a 10% threshold that it's trying to meet to stay below, really, in phase two. And so going over that is really concerning. So is the 7 rolling day average of that rate. So that sort of measures out any perhaps inconsistencies. That's at about 8.7%, according to AH Datalytics. And that really means that we are on a bad path. So are hospitalizations. They have grown more than 50% over the last 2 weeks.
You know, even as this has spread through communities across the state, the political divisions over pandemic response have seemed to worsen, if anything. Talk about some of the opposition that you found among Louisiana politicians to such things as masking, distancing.
Right. And I actually think masks is the big one to focus on, because that does seem to be the one that some politicians are deciding is the most egregious, or the one that they want to publicize. You know, we've seen the mayor, president of Lafayette, say that he's not going to implement a mask mandate, despite no evidence from his local health leaders that that's a good idea. In fact, they've said the opposite. We've also seen Congressman Clay Higgins, who represents Lake Charles and Calcasieu Parish. He's talked about conspiracy theories around the coronavirus. He's made false claims about how well masks work, and the medical consensus is that they do. You know, it depends on what type of fabric you're using, just how good they are, but they are definitely better than nothing. And he's called mask wearing sort of a part of the dehumanization of the children of God. But I think one of the most striking sort of headline grabbing politicians is Representative Danny McCormick. So he represents parts of Caddo Parish, and Caddo Parish is where Shreveport is. Shreveport has had 243 people die since this pandemic's outbreak. Black people there are dying at twice the rate of white people. And he has made some really striking claims about what masks are, you know, masks being an infringement on liberty.
The Constitution is being shredded before our very eyes.
This isn't about whether you want to wear a mask or you don't want to wear a mask. This is about your right to wear a mask or not. This is about liberty.
Your body is your private property. If the government has the power to force you to wear a mask, they can force you to stick a needle in your arm against your will. They can put a microchip in you. They can even make you take the mark. After all, it's for the greater good.
I think the main thing to focus on here is that I have not seen, nor has it been publicized, that Representative McCormick has been making positive statements about public health guidelines. And I think that's a really important thing. In this moment, when we are seeing the virus spread the way that it is, when we are seeing our neighbors really impacted by this virus, it is a striking time to come out with a message that undermines public health advice, and not in any way to indicate in that video whatsoever the need to abide by these guidelines, the ways that they can help us really prevent another shutdown, because that is where we will go if we do not get a handle on these rising cases. It is not given that the state could not move back to some kind of shutdown. It's not a given that schools will open. None of the progress we might want to see is a given right now.
You've spoken with some medical professionals who were on the front line, if you will, in terms of fighting this pandemic. What are their thoughts when they see some of the political vitriol launched in their general direction?
Yeah, I really was struck by comments made by doctors in Lake Charles. They were speaking in a video to their mayor, Nick Hunter, and he was pleading with the public to listen to these local officials. And they were really denouncing particularly the politicization of mask wearing, and talking about how crucial it is, how upsetting this politicization is. You know, doctors are wearing these masks for hours, 12 hours a day in a hospital. Why can't people just wear them for 20 minutes in the grocery store? You know, we wear our seatbelts when we are driving. Why can't we wear masks in public to really try and make this difference? And I also was struck by Susan Hassig. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at Tulane University. And she is extremely upset that we are in this position.
Frankly, it's been really, really frustrating, because just a few weeks ago, we were in a really pretty good place. The curve is going to bounce back up if we don't keep jumping on it and stomping it down.
Susan Hassig from Tulane speaking there. Rosemary, what are some of the big concerns about where we're headed with these caseloads in terms of medical capacity to cope with these rising numbers?
Well, I think we learned from experience in April that our hospitals being overwhelmed is not out of the realm of the possible. And so when we see hospitalizations grow, particularly when we see ICU beds decrease, particularly, that is a sign that that's the trajectory that we're on. And actually, one of the things I've been hearing is that medical staffing is going to be a big concern going forward. And that's going to be different than it was in the spring. In the spring, we had a few areas of the country who were that were spiking in cases. And we saw Louisiana ask for people to come from around the country to help us out, for example. Now, the spread is so much greater. The number of states facing rising cases is so much greater. And that's really going to put pressure on staffing. We aren't going to be able to ask for the same movable resources, movable people, contract workers that we saw come in the spring. And so what I'm hearing for people is that those staffing concerns are going to be the number one reason maybe that we can't help people. As one doctor said to me recently, we can always find a bed. You can always find somewhere to put someone. But if you don't have the staff there to treat them, that's when you're really out of luck. And I think that's the big concern right now.
That's Rosemary Westwood reporting for WWNO New Orleans Public Radio. You can find her latest comprehensive reporting at WWNO.org. Even as the medical profession worries about the trend lines, tourism and marketing professionals in New Orleans are fretting about their bottom lines. The French Quarter has reopened to visitors, though with significant city and state restrictions. Now, the numbers in the quarter and even on world-renowned Bourbon Street remain a far cry from pre-pandemic levels, but there are serious health risks to be found there all the same. I spoke this week with our friend Mark Allen Derry. He's an infectious diseases doctor with Access Health Louisiana.
Our tourist industry pre-COVID-19 was essentially based on bringing as many folks here to New Orleans and maybe packing them into a room, into a nightclub, into a bar, into a restaurant, onto the street, street band on, corner band on Frenchman Street. Everybody's pushed together. That is the perfect vehicle for transmission for COVID-19. There is no better way for a virus to transmit than in spaces like that. And so I would challenge the tourist industry to radically rethink how we do tourism in New Orleans. And I would challenge the New Orleans musicians and the business leaders and the entertainment leaders and those really innovative thinkers that we have to do things differently, because the way we were doing things before, I don't foresee this ever really coming back. Because again, I think we've mentioned this before on this podcast, is the things that got us to COVID-19, there's no reason to think that we won't see a COVID-22, right? And we're already seeing rumblings of a potential new H1N1, so-called G4 virus in China right now that has a very high likelihood of becoming, it has very high transmissibility. We haven't seen human-to-human transmission, but that's just a genetic mutation away from that happening. And so I think it's time for us to rethink the way we do tourism. I think it's time for us to rethink the way that we do entertainment here in New Orleans, because the old ways were were very classic ways for viral transmission.
I spent some time in the quarter Wednesday evening trying to reach out to some of the people walking about and get their thoughts on COVID-19 and the pandemic and the response. It was remarkable to me that there was some recognition among visitors to the city of the perils that our tourism economy is facing. We'll hear from a man here who was in town with his wife from Atlanta. Let's listen.
We've been here all week since Monday, and we're going to leave out probably tomorrow, maybe Saturday.
Okay. Let me ask you about how closely you're paying attention to the pandemic.
Very much, very close. What's really concerning me is the businesses and people without jobs. And truthfully, I don't even think the pandemic has really, we see the real results of this thing yet. I think the worst is yet to come, because there's going to be a lot of people without work, homes lost, jobs lost. These people cannot survive. These businesses up and down Bourbon Street can't survive the way I look at it today. Yeah, they may get some weekend business, but they need that business they had that used to.
It sounded like you were wearing a mask and he wasn't.
That's right. That's right.
This comes to where we're also asking visitors when they come to New Orleans to please be masked because it helps our frontline workers who are there to provide services for our tourists. And we recognize that the masks that you wear protect our frontline workers.
Let's stay on that topic. This next clip was an interview with a couple of visitors to the city. Let's just listen.
Where are y'all from?
Chicago.
Atlanta.
And how long are y'all visiting the Crescent City?
I've been here 2 days.
How did y'all feel about coming in into New Orleans, given that everybody's got, you know, coronavirus concerns these days? I mean, did you feel like it was still a good gig in terms of a deal coming in?
Oh, price-wise, yeah, everything's cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, accommodations were very reasonable compared to what they would normally be at this time.
I am a teacher, and I usually have all summer off, so I'm just like, I'm sick of being on my couch.
Yeah.
I'm definitely still social distancing. I've been to like some places in Florida, like Panama City Beach, like it's just packed.
Yeah.
Packed, people on people on people. It was uncomfortable because, you know, like Florida's a hot spot, Texas is a hot spot. I don't know about this.
Well,
I don't
Louisiana even... is a hot spot now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
The mayor actually announced new restrictions on seating at bars and restaurants today.
Because you know it's not good because it's pulmonary, so it's like it goes
right in
the air. So,
well,
like,
I mean,
right now, you're wearing your mask. You're being cautious. It's probably your job. You have to.
Sure.
It's a facade. You're, like, making sure that we feel safe. But we're outside. The spread, it's not congested.
Because audio doesn't tell the picture, you're not wearing a mask, but you feel safe outside.
Absolutely.
not wearing a mask.
Yeah.
De-mask indoors, like when you're going to
restaurants. I do it just to make people feel comfortable.
Yeah. You say you do it more to make others feel comfortable. Do you put any stock in the value of the precaution in terms of masking?
I mean, absolutely, because that's the value in... Yeah, because we can't overstock our hospitals, and you want people that need the treatment to happen. My friend in Texas, she just had it. She's quarantining, and that's what needs to happen. Because you gotta, like, because we have to make sure that everybody gets through as best as we can. We can only do so much, and this is what we need to do.
I mean, there were a couple things here. One is they're, you know, just strictly speaking from a medical, you know, and I understand they're not medical people, but they had the basic understandings. He said this is pulmonary. He meant to say this is a respiratory virus. So he understood that it's transmitted through the air, right? It's potential airborne. And we saw news today on the day we're recording this on Thursday that the WHO is now recognizing this to be an airborne virus, which is new because it used to be thought to be droplet. But then he says, you know, you're wearing the mask to make me feel safe. I think you're wearing the mask because it's the right thing to do, and also because it's mandated in the city of New Orleans to do so, right? That's why you're wearing the mask. Also, let's be very, very clear. Can you get COVID from being outdoors? Yes, you can. Is it more likely to get it indoors than outdoors? Yes, you're more likely to be and he used the word congested. You know, he meant to say, you know, this is not a crowded area. And so if you are in a crowded area indoors versus a crowded area outdoors, yeah, you'd rather be in a crowded area outdoors. If you were in a crowded area indoors masked versus a crowded area outdoors masked, I'd much rather be in a crowded area. If I had to be in a crowded area, I would rather be outdoors and masked. And remember, the one time I was in a crowded area outdoors was during the Black Lives Matter protest. And there's not one, 90 to 95% of everybody was masked, and there was not one case of transmission that has been attributable to those protests. So this clip is very important because you see people who have, like, I could tell they understand things. And if there was somebody like me who could just nudge him over, because he was also talking about his friend who just got out of the hospital or was sick from it and needs to be quarantined. And they also understood that we can't overwhelm hospitals, but they're not connecting the dots. They're not able to go from A to B to C to D all the way to Z. And I'll tell you the reason why. And the reason why is that we don't have any central coordination of our government in terms of, or one voice, so that actually describes and explains these things. You have multiple different voices. And what that does in a public health crisis, it actually makes things worse. It doesn't make it better. And that was a perfect clip of just that. You had people who understood it, but they just weren't able to seal the deal. They couldn't wrap it all up into one. That's a good clip.
Spoke with three ladies who were visiting the quarter from the day. They had some questions for you, in fact.
I think we need to loosen up a little and let herd immunity kind of build so that the weaker don't have so many potential carriers around them, so that we can develop a kind of an immunity and let those who can handle it and get over it so that it kind of runs its course.
I'm curious about the possibility of reinfection. You know, is it realistic to expect that there's going to be some kind of immunity, or, you know, are there studies showing if people are getting reinfected? You know, that I'm curious about that. I think that's a big question.
But I think the mask wearing is fairly useless when we're wearing basically a shirt over our face. We're not wearing any kind of, the labels on every mask say does not stop the virus. So why insist we wear something that has basically no effect? I'm not coughing, I'm not sneezing, and I don't tend to cough or spit on people in general. And yes, if I were having any sort of symptoms, I'd isolate, I'd keep a mask on, because I'd actually be spreading something.
A lot to work with there, Mark Allen.
Right. So, I mean, a couple things there. One is we need to remove this idea of herd immunity. We need to get it off the table. It doesn't exist. Right now, the CDC estimates that we probably had about 6% of the total U.S. population has been infected. Ochsner just did a wonderful surveillance study, which showed about 7.8% of the greater New Orleans area has had it. So, in, you know, when you look at the total global deaths, so if we have about 5% of the total globe has had COVID, and we've lost about 500,000 people with about 5%. For us to get to herd immunity, that's 70 to 90%. So now take, you know, if we're talking at for every 5%, we have 500,000 people. That's a lot of unacceptable mortality. The last thing about herd immunity, the epidemiologist in Sweden who tried to do this herd immunity experiment has gone on a massive apology tour and has said that that was a gross mistake for him to have made and regrets having made that statement. So that's herd immunity. So they talk about reinfection. So the idea of potentially being reinfected, very unlikely with this 2020 COVID season. Could we potentially get infected or reinfected with another virus as it has circulated and mutated through the globe and has come back to us in like 2021? Yes, that's potentially the case, but we're not there yet. So as it stands right now, it's very unlikely that people who have gotten it once are likely to get it again.
Finally, the point with the woman questioning the efficacy of masks and whether asymptomatic transmission is really as prevalent as some have suggested.
Let me be very, very clear here. Asymptomatic transmission is what's driving this illness. So she was like, okay, well, you know, if I'm, you know, potentially I have a cold, you know, I have symptoms and whatever, I'm going to go inside. I recognize I'm not going to go out. So what I usually tell people is that the symptoms that you're experiencing, that's your immune system responding to the virus. That means the virus has already been in your body for a couple of days. Okay. What happens is, let's say you get infected at day zero. Your immune system doesn't start producing symptoms until day 3 or day 4. Most people wake up and they feel crummy. They have a headache. They feel achy. You know, maybe they, you know, they're nauseous. Maybe there's some vomiting or something. That's not the day that you got sick. That was the day that your immune system kicked in. The day that you actually were infected was probably 2 or 3 days. Now, for this, I'm talking about the common cold or influenza virus, was probably 2 or 3 days prior to that. But you didn't know that you were in your pre-symptomatic phase, right? And it's the pre-symptomatic phase where you transmit virus. Think about it. From a virus's perspective, the virus is going to try to get you to try to infect as many people as possible when you don't know you're sick. When your immune system kicks in, most people, right? Most people, I've seen it as a doctor. I've been a doctor for 20 plus years. Most people cough into their elbow. They won't shake your hands. They won't give you a hug. Oh, I'm not feeling well. They make sure that they keep their nasal secretions into tissues and they throw them away themselves. You know what I'm saying? Like, most people are very considerate like that. But at that point, you're not infectious anymore. You're not likely to be infectious. The infection happened beforehand. Now, that's for a common cold, whatever. The same thing is with COVID. So the idea that people who are asymptomatic don't transmit virus, not at all. It's that asymptomatic transmission or that pre-symptomatic transmission is what's driving this pandemic. And then lastly, let me just follow up and just say the idea that masks are useless, that is unfortunately, you know, the misinformation that exists in our society about masks. Every single study it almost seems like every week there's new studies that come out that show how effective masks are. If this is truly a respiratory virus, that means that whatever comes out of your mouth could potentially become aerosolized. And so all of that stuff, a large part of it, somewhere it's up to 90, to some studies even show 100% of it is blocked right at your mouth because the droplets that leave your mouth in the form of what's called spittle, that is trapped in the fibers of your mask. Now, are some masks better than others? Yes, some masks are better than others. That's a whole other thing. But just the idea of wearing a mask and making sure a mask is on board at all times, indoors, outdoors, it's really important. I'm not suggesting that we mask at home, but certainly when we mask, when as soon as we walk out the door of our house, we have a mask on, whether we're indoors and outdoors.
And that's Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Watch out for his weekday podcast with Dr. Eric Griggs. Noise Filter is an information-dense daily briefing on the pandemic. You can find Noise Filter on Facebook. You're listening to Behind the Lens, broadcasting on partner radio stations 102.3 FM WHIV LP and 90.3 FM WAMF LP New Orleans.
I'm Charles Maldonado, editor of The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana, but we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website. It's thelensnola.org/donate. The Lens is your newsroom, and we thank you.
It's Behind the Lens, and I'm Tom Wright. It doesn't appear that new teachers from overseas who were expected to work at French immersion schools in Louisiana will be here by the beginning of the school year. That's according to state authorities, following last month's executive order by President Donald Trump, banning the issuance of certain types of work visas. Meantime, there's debate building over whether our state's special education programs are ready to end federal oversight. Marta Jusen looks at that.
This report was really important to the ongoing federal oversight that's been happening in both New Orleans, but mainly of the Louisiana Department of Education's oversight of special education in New Orleans. This report in particular was the third report in what is basically an annual report that these monitors who oversee this consent judgment send to the court. And what they found is that the state had indeed completed another essentially successful year of monitoring. They call that reaching substantial compliance, which is a legal term. And so because this is the third time in a row they've received that finding, it means that a judge could release them from this federal monitoring.
What's the reaction from some of the plaintiffs in the original lawsuit?
The Southern Poverty Law Center is the group that brought the suit on behalf of 10 families in 2010, and they settled in 2015. They don't feel that this is an appropriate response, and they don't think that the judge should release the department or the school district. And that's because they keep finding special education problems in charter schools here. Essentially, what the rift is that this positive finding essentially boils down to having said that, look, the state did what they were supposed to do and that they monitored, they went to schools and they looked at them. Just because they found problems doesn't mean they didn't monitor them. But meanwhile, civil rights advocates like SPLC are saying, look, that is not what you guys came here to fix. You came here to make special education better and you're still finding problems.
Can you detail some of those problems?
Sure. Just a range of things from like individual education plans missing required signatures, schools failing to record service minutes or not provide special education services to certain students. Other schools have very low numbers of identifying new kids with special education needs every year. So that kind of raises the question, you know, are these schools looking for or evaluating kids for special education needs?
Meantime, NOLA public schools have a new requirement for high schools.
Yeah, so this is another step in kind of this full year we've seen of them stepping up their monitoring of and oversight of charter schools, independent schools that traditionally have not had this much of an eye on them from the district. And what they now want from high schools is they want a yearly course catalog from them. They want to see what classes are being offered at the high school. And specifically, they're making the high school show how the classes that they're offering are actually will translate to a diploma in 4 years. So that's a pretty big requirement, I think, to see out of the district, which, you know, is famous for its, you know, quote unquote, portfolio option of charter schools.
Marta, you've been collecting reaction from parents, from teachers, other school staffers about the district's reopening plans for the fall. What have you been hearing?
It seems like people are definitely interested in getting back to school, but definitely the chief concern out there for educators, parents, and students alike is safety. The district has put forward plans or, you know, kind of broad strokes plans of how we would hold class, depending on what phase the state and the city are in. But what teachers and parents are saying that they're not seeing right now are like specifics on how are schools going to be cleaned? Are teachers going to be responsible for cleaning them in between class periods? How's that something they can accomplish when they're expected to also be in the hallway, making sure that kids are safely going to and from classrooms? I think it's just a lot of the devil's in the details kind of, and they want to see much more from these plans than what they're being able to see right now.
And how can folks get in contact with you, Marta, if they'd like to share their thoughts about reopening concerns?
My phone number is 612-802-3063. And my email is mjusen@thelensnola.org. Those are both also on our website.
Very good. Marta Jusen reporting on the school's beat for The Lens. Thanks, Marta.
Thanks, Tom.
In criminal justice news this week, the COVID-19 crisis is costing the city's public defender system a huge amount of funding. That means a very serious bottleneck in our legal system. Nick Krastel has more.
So a portion of the public defender budget, about a third of it, comes from fines and fees that are generated, one through the courts. So when someone gets convicted in court, they have to pay fees that are then a portion of those that go to the public defender's office. Also, a portion of traffic tickets and speed camera tickets. Those things, since the stay-at-home order back in mid-March, have reduced drastically. The courts are closed, so there's very, very few conviction fees, and traffic tickets have gone way down. So back in April, the public defenders projected that they were going to have a loss of about $800,000 and started taking mitigation efforts. They furloughed some employees, and they stopped contracting with private attorneys who handle cases in which the office might have a conflict of interest. So those are that was kind of the issue and continues to be the issue that the Public Defender's Office in New Orleans is facing.
What sort of relief might the Orleans PD expect from the legislature?
There are a couple things. The new fiscal year started in July, and one way in which the public defenders get money in addition to the fines and fees is through the state public defender board, which is funded through the state legislature. In this session, this extraordinary session, when they passed the budget, the public defender board, the state public defender board, got a bit of an increase in money from the state, $7 million about. And that, I think, is yet to be determined how sufficient that'll be for funding, you know, the district public defender offices throughout the state. But the New Orleans public defender, Derwin Button, told me that the $7 million was a milestone in itself, and sort of signals to him a broader shift in how people at the legislature are thinking about criminal justice system funding. The other evidence of that is that there is a task force currently that was convened by the legislature to look specifically at the way the criminal justice system is funded. That was convened last year. They put out a report basically saying that the way it works is not reliable, that we shouldn't be funding our criminal justice system this way through fines and fees. What they did this last session was task the Louisiana Supreme Court and the legislative auditor to basically look at each district and create a uniform reporting system for these fines and fees, just to kind of get a sense of how much would be needed to replace them.
In the meantime, the capacity of the public defender's offices here in New Orleans and elsewhere in the state severely curtailed, given the financial strains they're facing now. Nick, a follow-up on a story you were talking about last week, reports of the inmate who had tested positive for COVID-19 at Orleans Parish Jail, that inmate having died. What's the latest from Orleans Parish Jail?
I obtained a memo from the jail director, Darnley Hodge, to a federal judge that basically said that everyone who had been living near the man who died in the jail and then tested positive, a man named Christian Freeman, was tested by the jail. It was 55 people. And he said in his memo that all of them came back negative. There was one outstanding test that hadn't come back yet. So he said that this death and subsequent positive test of this man at the jail, as far as they could tell, no one else had contracted the disease, which still leaves a lot of questions. We don't know how Christian Freeman got it in the first place. Presumably he got it from someone else at the jail. He had been in there since December. So that's about all we know right now. The sheriff's office, aside from the memo, hasn't been able to speak with them, and they haven't been putting out any public information aside from them.
Got it, Nick. All right, Nick Krastel, following criminal justice affairs for The Lens. Hey, Nick, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation has a new brand. The group has renamed itself the Pontchartrain Conservancy. And while the group remains committed to caring for the Big Lake itself, it's reaffirming its commitment to work on coastal and river issues that impact all of South Louisiana. We spoke with the Conservancy's executive director, Christy Trail, about how the group's mission has evolved.
A lot of people remember us from the late 80s and early 90s with the rallying cry of Save Our Lake, because Lake Pontchartrain was a heavily polluted body of water. You know, we started really grounded in science. There was a report written by some professors at UNO and Tulane back in the late 80s that really took the time to evaluate what would it take to clean up Lake Pontchartrain. recognizing that the state actually owns Lake Pontchartrain. You know, the state owns all water bodies. No particular private entity owned the lake. But there were so many entities involved in managing the lake. It really took a neutral party, if you will, to come in and put the pieces together, get everybody sitting around the table and recognize everybody did have the same goal of wanting a clean body of water. But that report was all based on science. So while there was this huge groundswell grassroots movement to get the lake cleaned up, we followed all the items in that report. It was almost a checklist, if you will, you know, stop clamshell dredging, check. Get the government entities all working together, check. Get businesses around the table along with residents and the government, check. You know, so we did all those pieces working everybody together.
Over a long period of time. Certainly.
Over a long period of time. It took until 2006 to actually get the lake declared clean. And also recognizing all the contributing factors to Lake Pontchartrain. It wasn't just the lake itself. It wasn't just clamshell dredging. You had rivers flowing from the North Shore that were contributing to its demise. So we said, hey, let's start looking over there. Katrina obviously hit in 2005. We're coming up on that 15th anniversary. That prompted us to look at how did that happen? How did that surge of that volume get into Lake Pontchartrain? How could we prevent that from happening again? That's where we really started looking at our entire basin and the coastline, because the coast and the wetlands are what's really going to protect us from having a storm surge event like that again, right? We need that buffer. So as you just kind of go through time and things that have happened to us naturally, we've evolved and grown. We've never stopped working at Lake Pontchartrain. We kind of consider ourselves the stewards of Lake Pontchartrain. We still sample it every single week, even today. Actually, literally today, we're out there sampling Lake Pontchartrain. So we didn't want to lose that core. We love the word Pontchartrain. That's why we kept it in our name. But we've just grown to look after what are the needs of this community.
Seems reasonable to point to the interconnectedness of the lake in particular with every other body of water that it's intimately related to, the river, the coast. There's clearly a recognition that what happens in one part of the state inevitably will affect another. And we've seen that with, for instance, the Bonnie Carey spillway operations, as frequent as they have been in recent years.
Yeah, this is just kind of part of the story of South Louisiana and learning to live with water. Right. And I will say that, again, we always consider ourselves grounded in science. So one thing that we push for and we talk about advocacy is making decisions based on science. So that is a lot of what we look after. You know, what are the effects of the Bonnie Carey spillway opening on the lake, on the basin? What are the effects of a high water event? And what are the effects of having a sediment diversion downriver? So we collect data continuously. We love data. You know, most of our staff are PhD scientists. I'm an engineer. We love charts and graphs and long sets of data, but that's what helps guide our decisions and us and our position, if you will, on how things happen. So if you look at something like the Bonnie Carey spillway, as I mentioned, it's a flood control structure, not necessarily designed for any sort of coastal restoration activity. But what's interesting to see is that it's been opened so much more frequently in the past couple of years. You know, when I first started here in 2016, it was a rare event for the spillway to be open. But honestly, it's opened every single year since I've been here. So now it's not that rare event anymore. What does that mean? We don't really know yet. We're going to need to collect some more data, really analyze what were those effects. How is it affecting the lake? How is it affecting the fish in the lake and the birds in the lake? We're still collecting and analyzing all that. But I think that's the new normal. That's what's so interesting.
I mean, certainly there's hard data coming in on the fisheries end, for instance. Is it your group's view that further river control projects are the key to alleviating the strain that Bonnie Carey openings are putting on other waterways? Do we need engineering solutions? And I'm asking an engineer. but also, you know, are those sort of projects easy to sell to the public from your perspective?
Well, that's a good question with probably a long, complicated answer that I don't have. But one thing that we would like to see as an organization is a good in-depth scientific study. That's our strength. We want to see the data to see what is the best way to learn to live with the Mississippi River. It's here to stay. I mean, it's really how Baton Rouge and New Orleans exist, right? We're very dependent upon the port. The communities that live along the river are dependent upon the river for various reasons, for fishing, for traffic, for navigation. So we've got to figure out how to manage the river and learn to live with it. Is it more flood control structures? Is it taller levees? Is it more, is it a combination of both? Probably all of those. But I think, honestly, we haven't taken the time to study the river, even all the way up to Missouri, down to the Delta. You know, what is happening? If we just try to look at the Bonnie Carey spillway and the, you know, old river control structure only, I don't know that we're really getting the full picture. And 2019 was just a crazy year for flooding. It was unprecedented throughout the whole country. Even the Pearl River was in flood stage for a record number of days. So we've got to, I would like to see, you know, the entities involved here, which again, we'd love to be involved, state agencies across Louisiana, Mississippi, up to Arkansas, you know, looking at what's happening on the river as a whole when it reaches flood stage and how are we going to manage it and learn to live with it and still retain our communities.
Certainly, you can't ignore the other end of the water picture, big water picture, and that's coastal erosion, sea change, the continued worries about that. As your group broadens its footprint, if you will, to encompass the coast, what sort of expertise do you feel like you bring to that discussion, that debate about what to do inevitably about our eroding coastlines and the dire impacts that inevitably has on communities?
So again, what our group brings is the science. So we've been collecting data along the coastline for about 15 years, looking at salinity data, temperature data, where the fish are, you know, whether that's oysters or shrimp or fin fish, where the boats are, you know. So we will go out every 2 weeks, collect samples, you know, whether it's from a boat or just a drive-by, of various areas all throughout the basin, looking at changes in salinity. We also will do a flyover every couple of weeks and take a picture, and we can see where the boats are. Where are the shrimp boats? Where are the oyster vessels? So we can see where they're able to harvest all that, you know, that the Gulf of Mexico and our basin has to offer. And we'll map all of that, and we publish those maps every 2 weeks. But now, having done that for almost 10 years of mapping all that data, we have these great long-term trends that we can look at. Okay, what happens when a storm comes? What happens in the summer? What happens in the winter? What happens in the summer and a high water event and a hurricane like we had last summer with Barry, right? Yeah. What are all those different scenarios, and what are the effects on the oysters and shrimp and salinity? Is it building land? Is it taking away land? And we're starting now to build that database of information that we can feed to the state and to federal agencies as they are making these decisions on big, big projects, right? Where we can say objectively, we've looked at the data, we've analyzed this. Yes, this will work, or no, this won't work.
You certainly raise an important issue in the minds of a lot of residents in terms of weather protections from the coastline as we have it now that naturally break a lot of the potential damages from hurricanes, tropical storms. What is your feeling right now on the state of coastal protections in this somewhat busy hurricane season?
Right. It's already starting off very busy. You're right. Mm-hmm. So today, are we protected? A little bit. Could we do more? Absolutely. And I think for a lot of communities, when we talk about, we use words like resiliency and we use words like vulnerability, right? And sustainability. What does that ultimately mean to people living in Southeast Louisiana? It means, do I flood? Do I not flood? Do I stay or do I go? That's really what we're looking at. How are, you know, us as a community living here, are we going to be able to stay here? If we're going to stay, then we can't flood, right? I mean, it's just, or if we're going to be in an area that floods, we're going to have to figure out how to live with it, you know, elevated home or an evacuation route or planning how to get out of there. Mm-hmm. And so for us at our organization, we talk about that as multiple lines of defense. So yes, you have the protection. You have the hard and fast levees and flood walls and evacuation routes. That's a key component for a lot of us living in this area, but it's only one component. We also need the wetlands and we need the barrier islands and even all the way out to the offshore shelf in the Gulf of Mexico to protect us from storm surge, because those items have to work together. You can't just build a bigger levee.
How difficult is it to promote that message when the country as a whole, and South Louisiana specifically, is dealing with some very imminent crises? And I'm thinking of COVID-19. I'm thinking about the focus on police brutality and racial inequities. How difficult is it for you to get your message heard in today's environment?
Yeah, it's definitely not easy. And it's not easy on a day when all these other things aren't going on, right? To jump up and down and say, hey, we're Louisiana. We have another problem again, you know. But we also like to remind folks from the rest of the country, how much do they like shrimp? How much do they like oysters and seafood that comes from our area? I mean, people do depend on having seafood from Southeast Louisiana, and that's not going to happen without our infrastructure. Similarly, we are very dependent on the oil and gas industry here. It's just the way of life in South Louisiana. That infrastructure is just so well built here in South Louisiana. If it's not protected, folks in the Northeast are not going to be able to keep warm in the winter. And so that's kind of what we talk about when we bring people down here. We're able to show them the coastline and just say, oh, we're not just asking for billions of dollars because we want more green grass. We're asking for this to support the rest of the country because we have all of this infrastructure down here. We have all of this seafood bounty that the rest of the country utilizes. So we can't just say, well, we're going to build some grass to keep the pipeline here. You still need the people down here to operate it, to maintain it, make sure it runs safely. Make sure that it all keeps intact and protects the wetlands. So it's all part of a bigger story and bigger picture.
Our thanks to Christy Trail from the Pontchartrain Conservancy. Go online to scienceforourcoast.org for more information and educational resources. That's scienceforourcoast.org. And that's all for this week. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. We'll take you to break with some fine piano work by Mississippi's own Bill Perry Jr. and the Bill Perry Project. I'm Tom Wright. Keep your mask on your face and New Orleans in your heart. Bon weekend.